This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, Andy Chow with Ohio Public Radio, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Later in the show, we'll hear from WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhart, who hopped a ride on Cincinnati's new streetcar today. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Andy, Lisa, and Howard, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, Lisa, we're at a point about 3 weeks in where we've seen 300 overdoses in the Cincinnati area from heroin.
That's right.
It's just like a storm has hit this area. Are there any signs local officials are saying that this is starting to abate, that this is easing to any degree?
I think that's what certainly everyone wants, and I think we're waiting to see some sure signals that that's where we're headed. You know, this has really just—it's drawn national attention to Cincinnati, to Ohio. If, you know, the New York Times, recent piece, I think it was September 6th that ran, just sort of detailing how this has impacted so many communities, and how, to a large degree, even though that we've had this sort of build up in the heroin epidemic, this seems to have really blindsided everyone, what we've experienced here in the last 3 weeks. And so certainly everyone's looking for signals and signs that maybe we've gotten through this.
Yeah, everybody's hoping we see something. It's been a horrifying time period. Andy, what's it look like statewide? I mean, for instance, other parts of the state, Columbus, where you're at, are you seeing similar problems, a similar surge in heroin overdoses?
Well, it's definitely that problem that just won't go away. Like Lisa was saying, it's gaining national attention because Ohio as a whole just has a very serious problem with drug overdoses, especially when it comes to heroin. Something that we saw last year rising, and it's still coming up today, is this fentanyl, the drug fentanyl, which is up to 50 times stronger than heroin. And the deaths of people who have died from fentanyl keeps increasing as well. And so, yes, it's a huge problem that the state is facing, and it seems like one of the biggest problems of all is that once state officials can really pinpoint what the problem is, the name of the game changes. So once maybe it was prescription drugs, and now it's just heroin on the streets, and now it's fentanyl, and it just keeps changing, and state officials keep having to call audibles to try to figure out what they can do to really stem the problem.
Yeah, so it's a moving target. It's hard to keep up with.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so like you said, Hamilton County, if we're just looking at the fentanyl deaths, which made up for about a third of all of the state's overdose deaths in 2015, Hamilton County definitely had the worst. It had 195 deaths related to fentanyl. Here in Franklin County, it's still a big problem. Franklin County, of course, is where Columbus is located. It's still a big problem. But we only had 40 fentanyl-related deaths. So Hamilton County is definitely leading that category as well.
I don't know that in all my years in this town, I have never seen what happened the other day with a county prosecutor going before a judge, along with Dennis Dieters, the county commissioner who's heading up this task force,
right,
and asking for something like immunity for people who turn in these drugs. I mean, it's absolutely unheard of that a prosecutor would go to a judge and seek that kind of authority.
Sure. I don't want to necessarily use the term desperate, but it shows sort of how much our leaders and our communities are grasping for a way to get a hold of this and to wrestle this down. You know, you hear about ambulance crews responding to 20 to 30 calls a day because of overdoses. And you just start thinking about the sheer size of and the impact on our resources from law enforcement standpoint, and then how that trickles down into just sort of, you know, your fabric of your community and the homes and how this is impacting people's lives. It, again, to your point, it's just eye-opening the steps that we're taking to try to get our arms around it.
And it's hard to tell if something like the immunity idea will work, you know, because it had, the details aren't really worked out yet exactly how this will work.
It certainly seems like something that can't hurt.
It can't hurt, but it's, you know, you're probably depending on the families and friends of the people who are using to get a hold of this stuff and turn it in, because the people who are using the stuff get it, use it right now.
Right, right. And here at WCPO, we have, over the last year, have been hearing from an advisory board that we created. It's our heroin advisory board. And so once a month, these are leaders in our community who come to us and talk about the epidemic and about the work that's underway. And in recent discussions with them about this immunity piece, you know, the feedback was it's a step, but it's one of many that needs to be taken. And sometimes what seems what we hear from the advisory board is that there still isn't enough attention on treatment and getting folks into treatment.
Yes, right.
Yeah, something that worries me, Lisa, is the heroin that's laced with carfentanil and fentanyl is so, so potent. So if you're asking a family or friends to turn this in, I would think that you'd be
it's dangerous.
You would be telling them to take precautions if you even handle this stuff.
Yeah, well, we've heard about first responders who are, you know, they're carrying, is it Narcan, on them for themselves because just, you know, so
absolutely.
Perhaps a snowflake is the way it's been described, could send somebody into an overdose state.
It's like the prosecutor, Joe Dieters, told the judge the other day, was talking to Rob Portman, senator, who said the DEA agents had dogs, drug-sniffing dogs, who were dying when they just sniffed this stuff.
And, you know, the topic of naloxone just came up, and that's something that even 2 or 3 years ago was something that on the state level officials were kind of worried about. They were, they were approaching it cautiously. They wanted to do a pilot program first. Now we've learned over the years, no, this is something that needs to be out there that family members and friends need to have, because it's something that can save people's lives. And that's just kind of showing you, that's just one example of the evolution of trying to fight this battle where state officials, local officials, they keep trying to find whatever they can do to really help the issue, to really try to fix this problem.
And naturally, the price of Narcan has gone up incredibly.
Right. That is true, you know.
And that's another, really a shame, but it's a fact.
And another
puts
example
pressure
of,
on local governments and the first responders.
Go ahead, Andy.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, we keep talking about how people just keep trying to find anything that works. It's not just going to be one silver bullet. It's a bunch of different ways to try to solve the problem. Something that some state legislators have proposed are creating tamper-proof pills where you can take a hammer to these pills and they will not break. And that's something that, I mean, if you really think about it, if you can get these pills that are prescribed for good reason to people, if you can make them so they can't even be broken up into powder, that's just one way you can try to help.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's talk with Thomas in Highland County. Hi, Thomas.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I realize I got a question and certainly a comment, and that is, yesterday when I was listening, I heard a figure of $50 million to basically, help alleviate this problem. Is that statewide, or is that just like in the Southern Ohio area?
My thought is, I believe that's statewide, Thomas. I couldn't swear to it, but I think what you're talking about is statewide.
For $50 million, we could see some genuine progress. And then here's my comment. And the, the state is sitting, according to what I found from the library, the state of Ohio is sitting on a $2 billion surplus.
Right, the rainy day fund.
Yeah, the rainy day fund. Yes. Yeah.
I got a sneaking suspicion the rain is coming down.
Well, you're right. And there's a lot of local officials in this city and elsewhere who, you know, have tried to put pressure on the administration in Columbus to spend some of that money on this.
You know, it's just a crying shame that we can't try these politicians for manslaughter.
But what you have to do is figure out what you're going to spend it on, mm-hmm. what you're going to spend it for. And as Lisa pointed out earlier, what is really needed is treatment. And treatment facilities, available, and get these people into them and get them help.
That, you know, that's exactly where I would anticipate more of the conversation and focus heading as this mm-hmm. issue evolves. And I mean, to the point of how much we might spend, what kind of resources we might put into this issue. I've heard it, and many of you probably have heard this as well, likened to, you know, if this truly is a health epidemic, right, if this truly is a health crisis, if this were the bird flu, if this were, you know, some massive outbreak of an illness.
West Nile virus, Zika virus are other examples.
Yeah.
Yes, they would be mobilizing.
Look at the resources we would be tapping into. But again, sort of the question out there is, where do you what's going to be effective? How do we curb this?
Andy, anything going on in Columbus, the legislature, as far as funding to fight this epidemic?
Well, the interesting thing that always happens, and we're coming up on yet another budget year next year, is that we have people come in who try to tell state legislators and state officials some of the ways that we can help treat this problem. One way of doing so is really looking at what we were just talking about, which is these treatment centers. Right now, there are certain drugs that are used for these treatment centers that might not be as effective. And I'm forgetting the name of the drug right now, but there are more things coming out that you can give these patients, these people who are addicted to drugs, that can help wean them off of their addiction.
Yeah, so you're thinking of Suboxone, I believe.
Suboxone,
yeah.
Thank you, yes. Mm. Yeah, and what it does is, you know, it blocks that need for more heroin, that need for more drugs, without making them dependent on yet another drug, which in this case would be Suboxone. And so it's just one of those things where we keep seeing people from all over the state come to Columbus, come to the state house and talk about these things. It's just a matter of who's willing to fund these programs, who's willing to really put the effort into creating more of these treatment centers and really following through with it.
You know, the discussion around treatment centers has, and this whole issue of addiction, right, has really, I think, evolved in our communities. And I think the thinking from our officials and elected officials has come a long way. You know, for the longest time, we looked at addiction as a moral failing, that, you know, somebody had to really hit rock bottom and figure out that they needed treatment and get themselves into treatment. And now we see leading health officials on the scene saying, look, this is a mental health disorder. We wouldn't put someone in jail because they had diabetes. We wouldn't, you know, tell somebody they had to hit rock bottom because they have heart disease. We need to tackle addiction the same way. And so this idea of treatment, getting folks into treatment, has become top of mind for the folks that are focused on the issue.
We will continue our weekly review of the news, and you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Thanks to Michael Williams for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Koenig, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, Andy Chow with Ohio Public Radio, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Margaret joins us now. Good afternoon, Margaret.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm very concerned. I appreciate you having this discussion both last week and this week. It's very important. I'm a psychologist in the Cincinnati area, and I'm very concerned about this. I live in northern Kentucky, and one of the problems we have here is that while treatment is available and money has been poured into that, there's a very scarcity of detox beds. From what I understand, there's only 10 or 12 beds available at any one time, and that when someone says, oh, great, I want treatment, they have to wait a week or two, which, of course, by that time, they're going to relapse.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The resources.
I'm wondering if they are addressing this detox issue, because people say, oh, treatment. Well, that's great, but you have to detox first, and most hospitals won't take you to detox. You can't just go into St. Eve's and detox.
You know, I heard the same thing coming from officials in Coleraine Township that have launched a new initiative to try to tackle this issue in their community, and they send first responders to the homes of folks who've recently overdosed and have been revived, and they talk to them about treatment options. But the biggest challenge is that next step. So somebody will commit, and then there's no detox bed available. And it sounds like the right people are starting to talk about this to draw some attention to it, but I don't know that there's a solution in place.
Yeah. The Coleraine Township program, are other communities looking at that, saying that's been successful, we're going to emulate that as well?
Yeah. And just to give a little more detail about that program again, so they've created this quick response team in Coleraine Township that includes an EMS worker, a law enforcement officer, an addiction specialist, counselor, and they review they meet once a week. They review the last 5 days worth of overdoses in the community, and then they go find those people and they talk to them about the incident. They say, look, we're here to help you. How can we help you take that next step? And to answer your question, yes. The city of Norwood has picking up pieces of it, and Coleraine Township has actually been getting calls from other states and communities in other states, and they're doing training and modeling for lots of other communities that have seen how effective it has been.
And they're finding this is a way to transition people to treatment as well.
That's so, right.
There's some talk at Cincinnati City Hall too about looking at this.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Diana in New Richmond. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I've been a social worker for 39 years in the Cincinnati area, and I've seen firsthand the success of heroin addicts who are using either buprenorphine, any kind of medically assisted treatment, Vivitrol, buprenorphine, which is Suboxone, methadone. And we just keep talking and talking and talking about what are we going to do, and we have to make sure all this Narcan's out there. But when people are coming into I work at University Hospital in the emergency room, and when people are being discharged at 10, 15 people a shift who have been Narcanned by the EMS people, and they bring them in there and then discharge them with no treatment plan, sorry, but that's not going to work. It's just going to keep happening. We can't keep talking about it.
Right.
And I agree with the previous caller that we have to have more detox beds, and then we have to offer medically assisted treatment individualized to each person. And if that's not available, heroin tells the addict what to do. Abstinence is not an option with heroin. And that's it. And I appreciate you doing these shows. Thank you so much for the attention that you're bringing to it.
And that's probably exactly what's needed. But that's a tremendous commitment of money.
When state officials were talking about Narcan, Naloxone.
Mm-hmm.
They did consider a measure in the legislation that would say, well, if you have to use this or an EMT has to use it, then that person needs to go get treatment, needs to go get addiction treatment. And I believe it was taken out partly because I think money-wise it wouldn't work out so well, and also when it comes to drug treatment, I think an element needs to be that person sort of making the decision. I don't know if forcing somebody into drug treatment is shown to work as well. I'm not sure. But it was something that was discussed when the bill was coming through.
It really just seems like hearing from Diana, and hearing from so many other voices like that, that it seems like an obvious next place to go. But to the point that has been made time and again here, where are those resources going to come from?
Yeah.
And, you know, how do our communities begin to shift resources, their very limited resources, into this area?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a situation in Ohio where local government funding has been cut, over the last several years. The cities just don't have the money. The townships just don't have the money, to be able to deal with this treatment program or the treatment programs and expanding, detox beds. I think, you have to look towards the state.
Well, let's talk about Ohio's medical marijuana law. That actually took effect, yesterday, Lisa?
That's right.
Okay,
that's
so
right.
Mm-hmm. That's underway now. And as the law takes effect, there's still a ton of questions about how this particular law is going to work.
Indeed. So, the law hit the books yesterday, and really what that signified was the beginning of what will be a 2-year rollout of rulemaking that will have to be taken up by the state agencies that will be charged with some oversight here. And, these rules will cover everything from how is this medical marijuana cultivated? How is it processed and then turned into medicine? How are we going to test it to make sure there's some kind of consistency here and that you're not getting strains of medical marijuana that have, incredibly high levels of THC? And then ultimately, how do you get this to the end user? How many dispensaries will be allowed across the state? And all of that happens in the form of business licenses that folks will have to apply for. So just so many decisions to be made going forward. The program is supposed to be up and running by September 2018. So we've got a fair stretch in front of us here.
What does this mean for patients at this point, though? Does this mean they can actually go out and get a prescription for medical marijuana or...
Well, letters from doctors, saying that they need medical marijuana or if they got caught with a certain amount of marijuana on them. But, that's not the solution to the problem.
Go ahead, Andy.
And right now, like what Howard said, you could go get a recommendation from a doctor, but I'm not sure if any doctors are really
not real anxious to do that.
Yeah, and there aren't people who want to be known as the doctor who gives out these recommendations right off the bat. And so I think there's some caution there. If and when doctors do start doing that, people could take that recommendation, go out of the state to another state like Michigan, and get that medical marijuana legally and bring it back here. But again, it just seems like what Lisa was saying, there's so many questions here, so many unanswered questions, that I think there's a lot of people who would be very apprehensive doing so, risking the possibility of legal action.
Andy, is it possible this never becomes fully operational? Because I know OPR has talked with the group that wanted to put this on the ballot before lawmakers acted on it. Is that particular group concerned about the direction things are going at this point?
I think right now they're staying optimistic about everything. There's always this worry that when you allow a certain amount of time to go by to really implement something, there's always a worry that lawmakers or other people might try to step in to stop it from happening. So I think they are a little worried about that. But in the meantime, I think that the Marijuana Policy Project is hoping that everything goes forward in the best way possible. And like we keep saying, this is a 2-year process, but it doesn't have to be a 2-year process. If the state gets the right people in place, you can have this control commission up and running. You can have these laws in place. They can do it under 2 years if they wanted to.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. So, Lisa, how much did that 2015 campaign to legalize marijuana across the board in the state of Ohio, how much groundwork did that lay for the point we've reached today where medical marijuana is legal in the state?
It's funny. I think depending on who you ask that question to, you might get a different answer. If you talk to, the folks behind Responsible Ohio that really pushed forward that Issue 3 campaign, they are very committed to the fact that this got the attention of lawmakers and decision makers in the legislature to pay attention to medical marijuana, at least, or marijuana legalization more broadly. When you talk to folks who maybe were critics of the Responsible Ohio Plan, they'll say, okay, that's fair. They get some credit for drawing more attention to it. But this is really about patients getting access to this medicine, and Responsible Ohio was about profit. Right. So it's funny, depending on who you talk to, how much credit they might give a Responsible Ohio.
And this is much more palatable for legislators, you know, when they look at polling that says almost 90% of people favor medical marijuana in Ohio.
Sure. I would say that as the Responsible Ohio campaign marched forward, much of that polling was taking place, and then legislators were paying attention to that 80%.
Yes, yeah, that piece of it.
And the legislators I talked to, they said, you know, indeed, we were surprised that was sort of the will of the community, but it is what it is, and we are, and you know, we're in the role to legislate in that way.
Yeah, legislators like to do things that make people, you know, happy.
Indeed.
And, you know, Responsible Ohio had the money to get all those stories out there, the stories the kids who suffered from epilepsy.
Exactly.
And all these stories were in the forefront. And you asked how big of a help was Responsible Ohio to getting the current law passed. The night that Responsible Ohio's issue failed, you had people, Republican leaders like Mike DeWine, John Husted, Mike DeWine, the Attorney General, John Husted, who's the Secretary of State, these big officials saying, you know what, we really need to seriously consider medical marijuana. And I think it was because of those stories, it was because of the public support coming out for medical marijuana that really pushed more of the conservative leaders to lean that way.
But at this point, it's going to be, what, at least a couple more years before the infrastructure is completely in place for this, Lisa?
That's what it sounds like. And to Andy's point, you know, they could do this more quickly. There is a timeline built into the law that says, you know, as of Thursday, within the next 30 days, this advisory board, 14-member advisory board has to be named that will have, you know, some oversight of the decision-making that will happen from three state agencies that have some authority here, which is the Department of Commerce. They'll be the ones in charge of issuing these business licenses for cultivation all the way to the retail piece. You know, the Board of Pharmacy, they set up the rules for how these dispensaries would operate and patient IDs. And the Department of Ohio's, let's see, what is the other one? The medical board, they'll be in charge of overseeing the whole patient registry, et cetera. So built within this law are dates that they have to have their rules in place all the way through September 8th, 2018.
Howard, we are now, 59 days, I think, and counting away from the election day.
Yes.
And, of course, Ohio is a crucial state for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to win if they want to win the White House.
Especially Donald Trump.
I mean,
no Republican has ever won the White House without winning Ohio.
Well, what's the level of campaign activity been like in the past week?
Well, I mean, it's pretty intense. I'm not so sure it's as intense in southwest Ohio as it is in central Ohio, in the Mahoning Valley and some parts of northeast Ohio, particularly the suburbs of Cleveland. But, you know, the candidates are in and out almost constantly. The money is starting to flow in terms of the TV commercials. And at least on the Clinton side, the ground organization is extremely well organized. It's not quite that well organized on the Trump side, but they're trying to play catch up.
Now, what's the latest polling showing?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, you know, Quinnipiac
kind of all over the map, isn't
yesterday
it?
Yeah. Said that, in effect, that this is a dead heat. It had Trump at 45 and Clinton at 44%. You know, I mean, that's no statistical difference between the two of them. It is going to be a very close election in Ohio, I think. just because that's what we do in Ohio. We don't have blowouts very often. And there are a whole lot of Trump people out there in certain geographical parts of the state, which is where he is working and putting most of his resources.
Well, why do you think Trump has done so well? Why has he been able to keep this state in place so well?
Well, part of it's just the frustration of, say, look at the Mahoning Valley with the people that used to work in the steel industry who lost their jobs, who somehow think that those jobs are going to come back, which are not. He comes in and starts talking about China dumping cheap steel into the U.S. and into Ohio, and talking about how bad the U.S. trade deals have been. And that resonates with a whole lot of people in those areas who have been personally affected by loss of jobs overseas. And they like the message.
Andy, any specific feeling about the Columbus area, how it's leaning?
Well, Columbus is usually a pretty big Democratic town, even when you mm-hmm. get out of the city and into Franklin County. And I think that's why you're not seeing a whole lot of Trump right here in central Ohio, and why he goes more towards maybe Dayton or, like Howard said, the Mahoning Valley area, and he was in Cleveland yesterday.
Yeah.
And I would say that's exactly who he's trying to target, are the blue-collar workers, the people who have already had this message in their heads that, why did I lose my job? Why is my neighborhood not good? Who can I blame for these things? And Trump is really able to target those people and really connect with those people. And so when he does talk about trade, he's saying things that these people, like the steel workers or the other manufacturing workers who have been laid off or have lost their jobs, they've been saying this kind of stuff for years now. And now they hear somebody saying that, and he's connecting with them. And I will say, if you look at all the swing states, if you look at Florida, Pennsylvania, Colorado, Ohio has consistently been the one where Trump is polling closest to Clinton.
Right.
And so that's why we see him all the time. I look up at the news, and you see when he's coming to Ohio, and it's almost every other day that he's here. And so he sees this as an absolute must-win state, not just because of the history of it, like Howard said, but because if he's gonna win a swing state, it's got to be one like Ohio.
Oh yeah, and Florida too is pretty much a dead even state, and that's one that there's a formula that says you take two out of three in Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and you win.
And you see him working to, appeal more to women, too. He just launched his Women for Trump Ohio tour here in Cincinnati. It was this morning. I think it was Laura Trump was here down at the Hilton Netherlands talking to women. And he's going to be in or that campaign will move then to Dayton and I think another stop in Akron. So to the point that he's spending more time and resources here, you're seeing it.
Another crucial race we have going on, of course, is the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Rob Portman and former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland, Howard. And where do things stand in this race? What's the latest polling show on that?
Well, again, I mean, the polling had been running by 7, 8, 9% in favor of Portman over Strickland, and Strickland just seems to be slipping away. The Democratic Party organization's starting to pull a whole lot of money out of Ohio. That could have helped him. The Quinnipiac University just came out at noon today with a poll that has Portman up by 11 percentage points, 51 to 40 over Strickland. And they basically say, look, this thing has just gotten out of hand. They don't think that Strickland can come back.
Well, you've seen, the Portman campaign and others spend a significant amount of money. We have a story on WCPO.com now. Yeah, at $45 million against Strickland. So that's substantial.
And it's the money. Yeah. And it's the money. It's all, the money, the independent expenditures, the amount of money that Portman is able to spend. But it's also the organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, his organization is first rate, on the ground. And ground game means a whole lot in these campaigns. He's running, far ahead of Donald Trump, and that's
Howard, I think it's interesting because a lot of the analysts were predicting that Portman would have problems with Trump at the top of the ticket. And they were saying that about a lot of races across the country, that with Trump at the top, you were going to see a lot of the down-ticket GOP races struggle. No, he seems to be bucking that. Yeah, it's not the case at
all.
That's
not the case in Ohio. I mean, Rob Portman is obviously outpacing Donald Trump. If anybody's going to help anybody, it's going to be Rob Portman helping Donald Trump.
And Portman's been able to pull off a lot of interesting things here. One is that he's had this reputation as being an inside Beltway person, somebody who's a DC insider. Yet over the past couple of months, he's been really successfully able to paint himself as an Ohio guy who's traveling all over the state, and then
pointing out that old RV.
Right, and pointing out, like, hey, where was Strickland this weekend, and where was Strickland there? And there have been times where Strickland has not made a lot of public appearances. Meanwhile, Portman's just hitting the road and doing event after event after event, and it's been a stark contrast between those two in that way.
The Quinnipiac poll that just came out, one of the craziest things I've seen yet in any of the polls was this number. It said that women go 46% for Portman and 45% for Strickland. Now, that's just counterintuitive in a race between a Republican and a Democrat. Democrats, you know, have dominated the women vote for some time. But it's dead split. And men are backing Portman 57% to 33% for Strickland. So, you know, if you have that kind of situation, if he can't even win the women's vote in Ohio, I just don't know how Ted Strickland pulls this off.
And Howard, before we hit the break here, I want to talk about City Councilman Kevin Flynn.
Yeah.
He announced this week that he's not running for re-election next year.
He is not.
Why not?
Well, I think Kevin's just tired of it. I think he ran twice and lost, and then he ran a third time in 2013 and he won. He's butted heads with John Cranley over the streetcar, obviously, although he's been, for the most part, an ally of Cranley on city council. He never struck me as the type of person who was going to be a professional politician. He's more interested in process than the politics of the thing. And I think, you know, he believes that he's done what he can do and wants to move on. But what that means is there are going to be at least three open city council seats next year. Yvette Simpson is running for mayor against Cranley. Charlie Winburn is term limited out. Kevin Flynn has decided not to run for re-election. So what that's going to do is draw a crowd, I mean a big crowd, for city council next year.
And Flynn hasn't hit his term limits yet, so at some point he could come back if he wanted to, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, he could sit it out for 4 years and come back if he wants to. I mean, he was kind of half-joking about that yesterday when he was talking to reporters. But you know, it's for now, he's off the table.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Andy Chow with Ohio Public Radio and WCPO.com's Lisa Bernard-Kuhn and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson will be back for the next segment as we talk with WVXU's Bill Reinhardt, who got to hop a ride on Cincinnati's new streetcar today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. If you missed any of this afternoon's show or you want to listen again, tune in Saturday morning at 7 for an encore presentation. The show audio will also be available on our website, WVXU.org. WCPO.com's Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, WVXU's Howard Wilkinson, join me along with WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt, who got a chance to ride on Cincinnati's new streetcar today.
Welcome aboard.
Good.
Please stand clear of the three cars and carrying food. say you were on the last one?
Well, I rode during the day. The very last streetcar was at 6 o'clock in the morning at 5th and Vine Street. That was a very sad day in my life, a very sad day, because I was 15 years old, and as a kid, I would ride on Sunday passes, and of course, I had a nickel pass from school, from St. Mary's Grade School in Hyde Park, and I was only supposed to ride like 8 blocks to my house, but I would stay on and go downtown and come back. So I got a lot of trolley car miles behind me. It's a joy to have these trolleys back. It's a real joy. We are so happy. We are so happy they're back. We're going to do a lot of trolley riding. We're going to be on these a lot.
Let's do it again!
Bill, that's impressive. You found somebody who rode that was 1951 when the trolley system was shut down in Cincinnati.
We were lucky enough to get on the final car with a Mr. Larry Fobiano, who I happened to overhear him say he rode the last day of the last streetcar in 1951. And he was very happy to see the streetcar come back.
Well, is that the sense you got? I'm assuming this was packed. It had to be a big crowd.
They had 5 inaugural cars. I was on car number 5. Unfortunately, there were only 4 cars available, as one was in the shop for repairs. So we had to do a little bit of waiting for the first car to come back and become then car number 5. And there were... They filled every one of those 5 cars for the inaugural loop, and each station we passed, there were dozens of people there waiting to get their chance to ride the streetcar. And after ours went through, the next one would come along, and apparently that's when the free streetcar ride started.
Now, his sentiment, I mean, is that what you're hearing from a lot of people today? Boy, I'm really glad this is finally here.
Everyone down there... I don't think you could find a detractor of the streetcar. There were a lot of supporters, a lot of very enthusiastic people. A number of people came in from out of town, folks who lived in Cincinnati when this was first proposed almost 10 years ago, and had fought and supported it, and then for one reason or another had moved away. A number of people came back just so they could be here for the opening day.
Describe the ride, Bill. What was this like?
It was very smooth. It was a lot smoother than I expected. We did hit every red light on the loop.
Of course, you were on it.
But that's not really... Yeah, exactly. It's not the streetcar's fault. That's me. Whatever mode of transportation I take, I'm going to hit
every... You're going to hit every red light.
We were delayed a couple of times by people pulling into parking spaces and trying to make sure they got inside that white line. Because if you're on that white line along the streetcar line, they're going to ask you to move, they're going to ticket you, or they're going to tow you, because the streetcar needs a certain amount of room to get past just on the safe side. We were delayed a couple of times by people who had parked and then opened their doors to get out. So it was the streetcar driver is very, very cautious. Making sure, you know, there's plenty of room. We slowed down for a bus that had pulled over to let its passengers off, and it was awfully close to that white line. So we slowed down until the driver of the bus could reach out, pull his rearview mirror in to give us enough clearance room. Another thing I noticed, approaching intersections with red lights, we may have had a green light, but the pedestrian flasher would be counting down 7 seconds, and we would stop just because they didn't want us to get out in the middle of the intersection and have the light turn red. So we stopped at a couple of green lights, too.
So it sounds like the drivers were really doing a good job today.
Very cautious, very safety-minded.
Did you get to – now, how far did you get to ride? Did you do the whole loop?
Did the whole loop.
Did the whole loop.
From music hall to music hall.
And about how long did that take, Bill?
It took us about 30 minutes, I think. I was busy taking – pictures and video and trying to get
so time passed quickly for you.
I wouldn't say that. I was standing the whole time too, so you do hang on to the strap like you see in the movies, the New York subway strap hangers, and for the most part you're not going to be jostled around too much. You may get a little bit of the inertia when you stop and you start, or when it's turning around a corner, but it's not too bad if you're paying attention.
Anything surprise you on this trip?
Just, well, the quietness. You know, I wanted to do an audio postcard, as we call it, just to give you a feel of what it's like to ride the streetcar. And it doesn't make a lot of noise. I've noticed that from the outside. And on the inside, it's,
yeah, they're
very
warning,
muffled.
They're warning pedestrians, too. That's, yeah. It's quiet, so make sure you're looking when you cross
the
street.
Get your nose out of the phone.
You're not
going
to hear it so much as you're going to see it.
They do ding, and they honk the horn a lot at people who are walking along or very close to the line, crossing the street. Cyclists, too, got a lot of ding-dings and beep-beeps and honk-honks. Clang, clang, clang goes the trolley.
Yeah. So from what you saw today, it looks like this is going to be a pretty busy weekend then, isn't
this
it? Because they
should
have the free rides the entire weekend.
This should be a very busy weekend. Talking to a number of people while we were waiting for our ride, it's like, Bill, come on, you can get me on early, can't you? So a lot of very eager people out there.
How many dignitaries showed up for this? What was that like?
All of them.
Okay.
Everybody.
Even some who opposed.
They all spoke. Everyone got thanked at least once. Former Mayor Mark Mallory was there. Former Mayor and Vice Mayor Roxanne Qualls was there. They both got up and addressed the crowd and talked about the next stages, the next steps for the streetcar and for the city. Current Mayor John Cranley was there. We had several council members. We did not have a quorum, so we were missing a couple. I did see former Vice Mayor Jim Tarbell there, a number of people who had worked on the streetcar down and dirty, you know, doing the paperwork and all of that, the design stages. Saw a lot of just people I've run into around town.
And I understood you said they're talking about the next stages already?
Well, there's lots of talk. There's always lots of talk. There's nothing in the planning stages. There's nothing official, but there's always talk. There's always ideas. And there's a group in Covington that's talking about getting a streetcar over there and connecting it to the Cincinnati streetcar.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, they also, their streetcar, I think, existed up until just before Cincinnati's went out of business. I think it was maybe the late 40s, early 50s that Kentucky had a system. If I'm not mistaken on that, Howard can probably
correct me. I believe
that's
right. Yeah.
Howard, how does this play out as a political issue in the upcoming city council campaign and the upcoming mayor's race?
Well, I mean, it's number one, it's not an issue like it was in 2013. It's there. It's running. It's operating. Everybody is saying, from even John Cranley, who opposed the thing, I want it to be successful. Now the argument is going to be about, do we try to expand this thing up to the uptown area, up to the UC area and the hospitals, which is the second biggest employment area outside of downtown. That could be a political issue. Although, frankly, they can talk about it all they want. At this point, there is no money for it. Not here, not in Columbus, not in Washington. There's just no money for it. But nonetheless, it's going to be talked about.
And there's good reason to monitor sort of, what does this first year's worth of operations look
absolutely.
Like? What kind of revenue? Is it hitting projections, exceeding? Is it not? So,
and if it doesn't, then you're going to hear a lot of howling.
Indeed.
You're going to hear a lot of we told you so's, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, Bill, Lisa, and Howard, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WCPO.com's Lisa Bernard-Kuhn and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. Also, local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt, who had the fun opportunity to ride a streetcar. I'm envious, Bill. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Caney. The number of people who go missing each year has been called our nation's silent mass disaster.
We'll discuss efforts to find missing persons and how forensic scientists identify human remains on the next Cincinnati edition. We'll also hear about the latest People's Liberty projects, and Focus on Technology looks at how we'll get along with robots at work, in the home, and on the road. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.